1, 2, 3, car! The ranking is the hardest part. Every week we rank one more song. You rank them on faith, you rank them by the heart. The ranking is the hardest part.
Nice one.
Yeah, pretty good.
Little Tom Petty.
I'm proud of that one.
That was a good one.
I was listening to a lot of Tom Petty this week. I was on a Tom Petty kick.
I mean, Tom Petty's great.
It's always a good kick to be on.
Yeah.
There's never a bad time for a Tom Petty kick.
There's a reason he has his own Sirius XM station.
It's true. It's true. Only a few artists have that.
Yeah.
Tom Petty, The Beatles, Jimmy Buffett.
Oh, wait. Although this does not track.
I think it's more like a lifestyle for Jimmy Buffett. It's like Margaritaville lifestyle.
Yeah, because it's not like only Jimmy Buffett songs, right?
Yeah, I think there's more than just Jimmy Buffett. But
okay, so his is more of an inspiration than an homage.
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, I guess I can get on board with that.
The parrot head way of life. I don't understand that way of life, but that's okay.
I don't either.
It's not for all of us. That's okay, though.
No, it's fine.
That's okay. Hi, friends. How's it going? Hope you're all doing well this week. Welcome to episode number 104.
Hopefully we haven't offended all of our Jimmy Buffett fans.
And I know. I don't know that we have many. I haven't really ever heard any crossover.
Friends, let us know. Are you a huge Beatles and Jimmy Buffett fan?
Let us know.
There's got to be some crossover.
I'm sure there's some crossover. Yeah. There's got to be. But welcome to episode 104 of Ranking the Beatles. Hope you're all doing spectacularly. My name, of course, is Jonathan. Over here to my left, hello, my love. It's
Hi.
Julia. How are you, baby?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. It's wonderful to see you.
You've seen me all day.
I've seen you all day, but it's wonderful to see you right now.
Oh, thank you.
As always.
With my little headphones on.
You're so cute.
In front of my little microphone.
Oh, my goodness. It's adorable. I hope you're all doing great, though. Yeah. We are in the throes of summer. It's starting here. The heat is kicking up.
We're not even in the throes.
We're not even in the throes,
it's
but it feels
the
like the throes.
It's so it's hot.
Yeah. But we're keeping it cool here at Rankin' the Beatles, man.
Well, yeah, you got the AC cranked. I just went and grabbed myself a sweater because I'm like, I'm going to be freezing in like 10
cool,
minutes.
Baby. Well, really excited about this week's episode. Big, big fans of our guests. Really glad to have them here. Our guests this week are a duo of Liverpool-based songwriters who work under the moniker Soda Jerker and who've also parlayed their experiences into what might be the best songwriting podcast around, Soda Jerker on Songwriting. For over 10 years, they've sat and discussed the process with some of the greatest songwriters of the last 50, 60 years. Artists like Lindsey Buckingham, Nile Rodgers, Diane Warren, Elvis Costello, Noel Gallagher, Paul Simon, the late Michael Nesmith, and an up-and-comer you may have heard of named Sir Paul McCartney, among others. In 2016, the podcast was used as the basis for a BBC World Service documentary, The Secrets of Songwriting. And in 2020, their interview archive was added to the British Library in London for preservation and posterity. Basically, you know, they are creating the world's most expansive archive of interviews with songwriters and about the creative process and building this amazing collection of conversations.
That's pretty rad.
With the best songwriters ever.
Yeah.
So
that's pretty cool.
And now... As the route should be, now they're here on Ranking the Beatles.
The next logical step.
The next logical step in their progression. Excited to be a part of their journey. Humbled and honored. But really excited. This is one of my favorite podcasts, and I'm glad to have these guys here. Friends, please welcome from Soda Jerker, Brian O'Connor and Simon Barber. Brian and Simon, welcome to Ranking the Beatles. How are you guys doing today?
We're very good, thank you.
Yeah, great to see you.
Good. So glad to see the two of you as well. Real quick, just so our listeners know who's who, would you do a quick, my name is Simon, my name is Brian, so people can get the voices since there's two of y'all today.
Okay, my name is Brian.
And I'm Simon.
Excellent.
I'm the one you can understand much more clearly.
Oh, man. Well, it's great to have both of you here. You know, as I was mentioning before, I'm a huge fan of your podcast as a songwriter. It's one of those shows that I've turned to when I'm kind of, you know, looking for inspiration and looking to see how other songwriters go about the craft and, you know, how how it works for how the process works for other people. So it's been really, really interesting. And you guys have obviously, you know, really blown up with what you do, and you've talked to so many great writers. You know, but I'm curious, you know, for the two of you, you know, how long have you been working together? How did you meet? You know, how did everything come about for you two?
Well, we met at school actually when we were 12, believe it or not. Wow. So well over 30 years ago now. Eventually Si started playing guitar and stuff and was in a band. And then basically in order to join his band and be in his gang, I took up the bass and joined the band too. And then that split up and we just started writing songs together from that point, from our sort of mid-teens, really.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in bands and stuff. And then we had our own band, and then that sort of went by the wayside. So the Jerker emerged from that, which was a songwriting partnership between the two of us. And then from that came the podcast, basically.
Yeah.
In a nutshell, that's 30 years in a nutshell.
That is impressive. That's very impressive.
That's very efficient.
I'd have to assume as a songwriting partnership, you guys must feel some sort of kinship towards other duos, you know, like Lennon McCartney, Jagger Richards, things like that.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, we know how we work, but finding out how other people work is always really fun and informative too, because you just kind of get justified in terms of your own process. You go, oh, we do that as well, or you hear some new technique that you haven't tried before. And so, yeah, it's great having someone to collaborate with, really, and we've always done that, and we've always sort of bounced off each other, and I suppose we do slightly different things in the writing process as well, which helps, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We complement each other in some way.
Yeah. What kind of things have you learned through talking to so many, you know, legends of songwriting? You know, like I was obviously, you know, preparing for this, I was kind of going back through things and re-listened to the McCartney one and re-listened to like the Noel Gallagher one. Like, so that those are like right there, two of my favorite songwriters, you know, like mm-hmm. when you talk to writers like that, who are people that you've looked up to or that you really respect, what do you find yourself taking away from these conversations?
I mean, as I said, you know, you discover that even, you know, the most from the you know, if you compare like the most successful songwriter in the world to just the guy starting out in his bedroom, that there's not a massive amount of difference in terms of how they start mm-hmm. a song. You know, everyone's starting from nothing. They're trying to sculpt air, as we've heard it once described. You know, it literally, you know, and I guess from doing it for so long and speaking to so many people, you just realize how many ways there are to do it. It's just not infinite ways, but lots of ways, and no one way is the right method.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the result is something good, then it's valid. You know, so whether you're sitting and you're slaving over a song, you know, just on your own with an acoustic guitar, or whether it's a team of 10 writers in a, you know, in a writing session, if the result is a good piece of work, a good piece of art, then it's a valid way to get to that end product, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really a great way to look at it.
That is so interesting, because we've had such like a there's such a debate about when you look at the songwriters of a song, and there's, you know, artists out there who have like these huge, like 10 people on a song. And mm-hmm. it's like, well, you know, at the end of the day, it still makes someone feel something. Mm-hmm. So exactly regardless right, of yeah. whether it's one or 10 or 20 or whatever, like you're still bringing something into the world. You're still creating something that is stirring people and listeners, which is, it's more than I can do.
That's this exactly one, it. Yeah, it's
not a songwriter. Yeah. This one right here.
Yeah. No, it has. It's taught us. I guess one thing it's taught us is, you know, I don't think we were particularly snobbish to start with, but it certainly taught us not to be snobbish about things like that. The team of 10, 12 writers. You know, a lot of people pour scorn on that whole idea. Oh God, yeah. That's ridiculous. You can't write. Well, you know, if the result is something good that makes people feel something, that makes people happy, that people enjoy, mm-hmm. and it's fine, you know. It's no more or no less authentic than the earnest singer songwriter strumming away on an acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, both of those modes produce dreck a lot of the time.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
It's true. Yeah. Sometimes, like, you know, you're guy with an acoustic guitar is a little insufferable. I mean, there is the whole, anyway, here's Wonderwall. Like, that that came from a place like that.
Right. Well, you know, and I think also, like, accepting that kind of, those, that different style also is something that comes with, I guess, a bit of wisdom and age and maturity. I know, like, for me, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I probably thought the most, you know, the most valid way to be a songwriter was, you know, one or two people, you know, in a group or in a partnership working together to write something, and, you know, putting a committee together, you know, to write something is, you know, would be cheating in some way.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you know, it's just a song, and if it serves its purpose and makes somebody feel something, then great. You know, that's all that really matters at the end of the day.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Has there been any particular favorite episodes that you guys have had so far?
Ooh,
I have to imagine so talking to Paul McCartney was probably pretty unreal.
Yeah, I mean, well, that was the ultimate experience of them all, without a shadow of a doubt. That was the greatest experience we've had, because he's, you know, he's our hero. Even so, you know, and that was a good episode, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's my absolute favorite episode of The Laugh. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Just trying to think, Simon. Any recent ones you can?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I guess people in the position of someone like Paul McCartney, they get asked about songwriting, but they don't necessarily have to think about the production of their own work in great detail very much, because they are who they are and they just make their stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there are people who we've spoken to who you might consider more kind of workaday pop songwriters, who really have to sort of reflect on the process, and the process of collaboration and working with artists and making a career and sustaining a career and all of this stuff, which maybe a Paul McCartney has less to worry about, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So someone like, we released an episode today with Theo Katzman, who's a member of Wolfpack, but he's mm-hmm. got this fantastic solo career, and he just gave us the greatest hour of insights into his process and how he thinks about creativity and how he feels about AI and what he thinks about writing melodies and the sort of pop songs that he loves and why and all this stuff. And it was just, it's fabulous, you know. You can pluck these people from, you know, wherever they are in their career, and they can give you so much stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. we've just found, like, if we like what someone's doing, as we do with Theo, then sitting down and having a chat with them can just reveal more than we ever imagined, really.
Yeah.
Some people are just really, as I say, just really attuned to what they do and can verbalize that extremely articulately, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Someone like, I mean, I know you've had Mike Viola on your show. We've interviewed Mike a couple of times, and he's a perfect example of that. Or someone like Jeff Tweedy from Wilco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who else? We did an interview with Bruce Hornsby last year.
Oh, cool.
Which has become one of our favorite ones. He's just a fascinating guy and very restless creative person, you know. He's always sort of seeking to do something new or change his sound and just do what interests him rather than do something that he thinks, you know, fans of the way it is are going to dig. He's like not interested in that. He always wants to try and do something new.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite an inspirational episode, I thought. There's so many. Honestly, it's hard for us
to remember at this point, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Because we've had so much material, so much content.
Yeah.
But yeah, the most recent ones have been interesting because the people come from quite different perspectives. Like, we had Jessie Ware on, who's a really popular female pop star in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And she talked about being in a room and collaborating on these pop songs and having to sort of structure her day so that she could sort of write the song and then get home for dinner. And that's not what Paul McCartney's going to tell you, right. You know. So everyone's got like a different piece of the jigsaw. It's interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then you get, you know, I really enjoyed the episode y'all did with Michael Nesmith a few years ago, because he's esoteric about the way he writes and the creative process. And sometimes, you know, in his episode, I kind of had to re-listen to kind of grasp what he talks about, because he's so wordy and so well-spoken, and just like his vocabulary is immense. And, you know, things, you know, it's like, well, I don't understand how he wrote that, but I don't understand how he's explaining it either. So I have to go back and listen again with a thesaurus next to me to understand what he's talking about.
We encounter very different kinds of brain chemistry, we find, when we speak to these people. Some of them just have strange ways of putting things together in their minds, or they respond to stimuli in different ways, like images come to them and they can describe them in ways that we wouldn't. You know, they use particular types of language for things, and that makes its way into the songs, and that's why they have a kind of a unique voice. And just when they're talking to you, you can feel it or sense it, you know. They go down avenues you wouldn't ordinarily go.
Right. Yeah, we had to be on. Yeah, we had to be pretty sharp on the Mike Nesmith one, as I remember. Yeah, we had to had to concentrate hard. Yeah. Yeah, someone like Van Dyke Parks, I think.
Oh yeah.
I'd put in the same brackets. He's quite. I've got a very sort of esoteric way of expressing himself.
Yes.
You know, you have to really kind of pay close attention, and you know, some of the things he says, you're like, what the hell on earth is he talking? He told us a couple of jokes. I seem to remember at the start of the interview, the Van Dyke Parks interview, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
Which I'm still trying to work out.
But even just his approach to language, like when we called and he picked up the phone, I think it was a phone of that one, and he said, we said, we're calling from the UK, and he said, well, that's okay with me. And I thought, wow, like he's already trying to kind of riff off the sort of rhythmic patterns of the way we said that, you know. It's like that's the way those people actually think, you know. They think in very unusual ways.
What was the thing he said? Something about Liverpool taxi drivers, he said. The motto of Liverpool taxi drivers, boldly going forward because they can't find reverse.
That's what
he said.
But yeah,
which was funny.
He said it was emblazoned on their escutcheon. I don't know whether that was just an excuse for him to use the word escutcheon.
Yeah, definitely. That was a rare. Yeah, no one else has ever used that word on the podcast.
I don't think so. I can only follow. I follow him on Instagram, and he's truly funny on there, and a phenomenal pianist. But then he just makes these like super basic like low digs at Mike Love that I think are hilarious.
Oh yeah, he can't stand them.
Oh yeah, that's brilliant.
And he's not the only one.
No, not at all. So you know, being that we are a Beatles podcast, you know, I do have to start from kind of ground zero here for you guys. Where do the Beatles enter the picture for you? Where do you remember your first memories? You know, how do they first kind of grab, you know, sink their teeth into you? And I know, being from Liverpool, it's probably like air and it's always been there, but I'm curious your kind of individual Beatle journeys.
Yeah, I mean, from what I can recall, I was aware more of the sort of surviving, you know, I was born in 79, so I was not even two when John died. But so yeah, around sort of 84, 85, when I was like 5-6 years old, you know, you'd start to see the solo Beatles, Paul, George, Ringo, on various TV shows and things, chat shows and stuff. So I was kind of aware of them as individuals, and then separately from that, I was aware of these Beatles as this entity. And you know, obviously, yeah, being from Liverpool, there's the iconography everywhere, and I remember being in like Cavern Walks, which is a little shopping centre in the centre of Liverpool, near the cavern itself. And there's this Beatles statue there. So I remember seeing that as a kid. And then there was a garden fest, this thing called the International Garden Festival in 84, which this big outdoor event on the sort of waterfront. And they had a big yellow submarine kids apparatus thing that you could play on. And so, I just had a vague sense of them, really. And then probably late 80s, when I was like 9 or 10, you know, my dad would be listening to Beatles records and things, and I'd pick up on certain songs. And then I remember listening to like Abbey Road on my Walkman when I was around 10 or 11, and really sort of, I think that was maybe the first album I remember listening to. And yeah, so it's kind of fragmented, my sort of discovery of the Beatles. It was probably not until I was 14, 15, getting into music, playing an instrument, that I really fell deeply in love with everything to do with the Beatles, you know, and kind of studying the songs more and just learning more about the story and all that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Were your parents Beatles? I mean, I assume they were, you know, first generation, you know, around the same age as them. Were they Beatles fans? Were they encouraging of you diving into that?
Definitely Beatles fans. My dad probably the more active of the two. Like, my mum likes music, but she wouldn't go out and buy albums and stuff, but my dad would buy He used to have the LPs, but I think he left them at home when he like left home. Mm-hmm. So he ended up buying them again on cassette. So all my, you know, discovery of the Beatles was on cassette.
Yeah.
And he just played them around the house, and he'd, you know, if he noticed I was paying attention, he'd tell me stuff about them or whatever. But he didn't sort of inflict them upon me, mm-hmm. or impose them them upon me. It was just a gentle kind of indoctrination, if you like.
Yeah. And Simon, how about you?
I remember the first memory is probably playing singles. My mum and dad had, I wouldn't say an extensive record collection or anything like that. Mm-hmm. You know, the typical story we get from musicians is, oh, I was listening to my mum and dad's records. But they had a collection of stuff, and I remember I saw a standing there, maybe was a 45 or something, and I used to play that with my sisters, probably at the wrong speed. And I remember sort of getting a sense of those songs from that, and they had Rubber Soul and some other things which we probably played and didn't really understand. But my dad had seen the Beatles live. He'd seen them in London. Might have been, was it Hammersmith Odeon? I posted a ticket from that.
Yeah,
concert,
it was the Christmas shows in, yeah. Oh no, was it Finsbury Park?
I can't remember exactly. I thought it was Hammersmith, but
or maybe it was.
Yeah, he was a music fan, and he'd seen Hendrix and he saw the Beatles and people like that. And so I guess they bought those records and they had them in the house. But it was probably kind of as I got older, and certainly meeting Brian was a catalyst, I think, to finding that appreciation, particularly for Paul, because we kind of consider ourselves Paul guys, don't mm-hmm. we?
Yeah.
And I think once I got interested in music, I mean, we went to school in the same street as Strawberry Fields, so we had a sense of that Beatles iconography all the way around us growing up.
Mm-hmm.
But when we started writing music together, Brian's sort of infatuation with the Beatles, I think, probably encouraged me more than it had before. And then we both studied at the Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts.
Oh, cool.
Which is the school that, you know, was Paul McCartney's old school, and he became the lead patron of this new performing arts school in Liverpool. So if it wasn't cemented by then, it was certainly on the way, you know.
And
We sort of just followed that path from there. It became a kind of a pilgrimage for us until we actually met him, I think.
Yeah.
I should mention as well the influence of the anthology, because that was pretty big.
Yeah.
But I mean, for any, you know, for Beatles fans generally, but I think that, well, it introduced them to a whole new generation, really. I mean, I was already a fan by that point, but seeing that and, again, seeing the story presented in the way it was presented, as airbrushed as some of it may be, you know, whatever the right word is. But yeah, that was a massive thing, and because the Beatles were sort of everywhere around that time with Free as a Bird, and then the anthology series and the you know, the CD
mm-hmm.
Releases and stuff. It was just sort of wall to wall Beatles for a couple of years there, and as I said before, around that time we were getting into songwriting and playing instruments and things, so it all sort of coalesced for us there. And so the anthology was a huge thing in cementing our Beatle fandom, I would say.
I think, you know, it really can't be...
Wait, I have a question. Before you move on, I have a question about the anthology, because we talk about that a lot here. And
you've still not watched it.
I've still not watched it. I have zero plans to watch it. if I'm being quite honest, I don't know. Maybe you'll get me one day. But at the moment, no. Before the anthology came out,
mm-hmm.
how expansive was the knowledge of the Beatles? Like, were there as many, like, books and...
Yeah, there
like
had been...
Like, all of the... Yeah. Like...
There had been kind of, like, a burgeoning book industry around them since they were together. I mean, Philip Norman wrote, I think, Shout, which was, like, their official biography in, like, 68 or 69 it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were books kind of...
Oh, no, Shout... Oh, sorry, that was Hunter Davis.
Hunter Davis, thank you. So, yeah, it was like 68, 69, right? and then there were books throughout the 70s, and there was, you know, like, I think Ed Sullivan maybe did like a tribute to the Beatles before he went off the air.
Mm-hmm.
And then there started being like kind of like low budget TV films like The Birth of the Beatles that talked about them in Hamburg. And then I think early 80s, there was a documentary called The Complete Beatles, and they spelled complete E-A-T, which messed up my grammar for years as a student.
That's funny.
Because I constantly misspelled complete.
It's a great documentary. Yeah, I think I saw that years before I saw the anthology, actually.
Yeah. I had it on. I had a VHS copy of that as a child, and that was kind of the first, like, several-hour documentary. Okay. But so that world kind of existed and was more just like for the fans, I think, and for like the hardcore people that just kind of kept wanting to get the same, you know, buzz over and over again. And I think the anthology really, and this is just my own perception as someone same age as you guys, I think the anthology really kind of kicked it back into public consciousness as this global worldwide phenomenon that is just kind of omnipresent and always there. Also around the same time, they started marketing things very specifically for them. Like they didn't put like the logo on the bass drum was never on a single album cover when they were together, but that became the standard logo. Like they standardized their merchandise.
Interesting.
Everything became mass marketed and it was like merchandising. And that kind of all came around the same time of them just blowing back into public consciousness.
And do you think it was so, like, because that was on TV, right?
Yes.
Like, they aired it on TV and then they sold the DVDs.
Yeah.
So it was, like, easily accessible. Mm-hmm. Like, the VHS that you had when you were a kid, what was that?
The Complete Beatles, yes.
Was that, like, a little bit harder to find?
I rented it from a video store the first time I got it.
But yeah, eventually they sort of managed to get it deleted. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was because they knew the anthology was being made and they just wanted to clear the decks of any other Beatles documentaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was deleted sort of maybe a couple of years before. So it was freely available, I think, on VHS.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that's how I saw it. I think my dad borrowed it off a friend or something. So I remember having it in the house in the VHS box. And but yet now you can't. I'm sure you can source it from somewhere, but it's not been commercially available since the early 90s.
Interesting.
Yeah, but it was a very good documentary.
It's great, narrated by Malcolm McDowell, I think, isn't it?
Was it really?
Wow. Yeah.
Huh. I just remember it starts off like Liverpool. low voice. I just remember that vividly.
Yeah. There's no like. There wasn't any. There were no sort of contributions from any of the Beatles, but a lot of their contemporaries are in there, like people like Jerry Marsden and all those kinds of guys, and maybe Alan Williams. All the figures from the early days are in there, and it's really nicely put together. Yeah, it's definitely, if anyone listening hasn't seen it, it's worth seeking out.
100%.
And it's shorter than the anthology.
Yeah, I want to say it's maybe 2 hours, maybe a little bit longer, but it's not an 8-hour.
No, it's sort of feature length, really. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I've just always been curious about that. Like, what, like, pre-anthology, what was the study, like, of the Beatles? What was the story being told? Like, how widely available was it? Because I feel like a lot of people, like, were, like, kicked into high gear. It's mostly people, like, our age group. Yes. Like,
well, and also, like, our age, you know, like, you had the anthology hit, and then almost immediately on the tail end of that, for us, we started getting bands like Oasis and Blur and Pulp, and the Britpop phenomenon came in, and they were all saying, we're Beatles influenced, we love the Beatles, blah, blah, like, that whole, like, that was just this, everything was British at that point in time, you know, like, all the cool stuff was British.
Yeah.
You know?
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Congrats, y'all.
Good job to you and your fellow countrymen.
I can't take any credit for it, but thank you.
Oh, man. You know, musically, as songwriters, you know, what kind of influence would you credit the Beatles with? Like, you know, from an individual standpoint, where do you see yourselves as Beatle influenced?
Ooh, Simon?
Well, obviously, we match them in terms of our own skill.
Skill, sales, looks.
I think it's just the kind of, because when you grow up in Liverpool, almost every band has that kind of quality to them in some way, you know, whether it's the more kind of jangly Merseybeat sound or the kind of melodic sense or whatever it is. So I think a lot of bands in Liverpool rebel against that and try to sort of move away from it. And we probably were the same at some point. But I suppose as we've come more and more into studying songwriting, we've probably just tried to take a sense of their melodic gifts from it, I would imagine, because that's really, for me, you know, probably the strongest element. And so if we can find ways to write great melodies that make the kind of McCartney-esque leaps that he makes, then that would probably be enough for me, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, same for me, really. You know, the reason we sort of write songs together is we have a similar mindset and similar taste in things and similar taste in what catches our ear. You know, if one of us is playing the piano or playing the guitar, and you know, one of us, oh, hang on, what's, you know, we'll pick up on the similar kind of things. We both just like things that are memorable. And I think, you know, the Beatles wrote way more than their fair share of memorable things. They very rarely wrote anything that you can't instantly recall, you know, after hearing it a couple of times. I think that's like, not every songwriter necessarily striving for it, you know, to write the hookiest, most memorable melody. But for us, that's kind of essential, you know, a great melody, or, you know, a memorable, it draws people into the song. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, what you're saying with the song, then that can be revealed later. But, you know, it's got to be something that appealing to the ear.
Yeah,
you know, and that's what we're looking for when we sort of sit down to write something that sounds nice, something that makes us want to continue with the song. I always talk about, you know, a song being necessary, or an idea being necessary. You know, like you play something and I could sit down now and sort of put a few chords together and hum a perfunctory melody over the top and say, right, there's a song. But it wouldn't be much, you know. It takes sort of, you know, you need that initial spark. You need something to grab you and pull you in to the writing, in the same way as a listener will hear it and pulled into listening to the song. You have to hit upon something that, oh, right, oh, I like that riff, or I like that chord sequence. I'm going to pursue this now. I want to finish this. It's got to make you want to finish it. You know, and so I guess, yeah, and just in a general sense, I'm not sure if there's a way to not be influenced by the Beatles if you're a songwriter. To be honest, it's so all pervasive, in culture and in music, and you know, I think even people who don't realise it are being influenced by them, and you can't say that for a lot of artists, really.
For sure,
that's fair.
Yeah. Well, we're about a half hour in. Why don't we go ahead and turn our attention to this week's song and do a little ranking? Friends, coming in this week at number 112 is Two of Us.
I Dig a Pygmy by Charles Hawtrey and the Deaf Aids. Phase one in which Doris gets her oats.
Song of what will become the Beatles' final release studio album certainly traveled a long and winding road.
No.
Well,
nice.
Thank you. While many speculate the song is about the relationship of John and Paul, its origins actually come from road trips taken by Paul and Linda, as the new couple frequently found themselves taking time to go for drives to nowhere just to see where they'd end up. There's even a gorgeous photo Linda took of Paul on one of these drives. Their Mini Cooper parked in the middle of a field, Paul sitting half out the car, playing an acoustic guitar and actually working out the beginnings of this song. Paul brought the song to the Beatles on January 2nd, 1969, the first day of the sessions for the Get Back project. At this point, though, he demoed it on an acoustic. It took on a full band electric arrangement. Despite engineer Glenn John's initial early suggestion that the band try the song acoustic, the band plowed on ahead with electrics, with a galloping feel that would be a precursor to the not-yet-written Get Back. And though the style is in flux and it feels kind of clunky and unsure, the one thing that's present the entire time is Paul and John's Everly Brothers-influenced two-part harmony that runs throughout the song, a move from their bag of tricks that they hadn't used in quite some time, but one that was always popular in the early days. Now, the song was worked on for the first few days of the session, and eventually, as George got more comfortable with the song, he began adding more lead guitar parts throughout. However, the song's author wasn't so keen on these parts. Paul continued to push back on George's contributions, a situation which eventually resulted in the infamous, "I'll play whatever you want me to play or I won't play at all, whatever it is that will please you, I'll do it" discussion, as seen in the Let It Be film. And while this is somewhat of an important moment in the band's story, it's been discussed ad nauseum over the years on a number of podcasts, including ours. I don't think it's necessarily 100% worth getting into discussing this particular line in this part of the episode right now. So George leaves the band, though, on January 10th, and the song is put on hold until January 23rd, with George back in tow, and the band makes several passes on the track before finally turning to try it as an acoustic number on January 24th. Now, Paul is inclined to not play bass on the track since he wrote it on the acoustic guitar, and despite his insistence that he likes songs that they've done previously that have no bass, George comes up with a bass part that he can play on his guitar to add some semblance of bottom end to the song. So the song is run multiple times over the next few days' sessions. The band perform on the roof of Apple Records on January 30th, and acoustic guitars are seen on the rooftop, leading to the possibility the band may have thought about performing the song up there. The performance is, of course, cut short by the police, and the following day, the band run through 7 full takes of the song, with a version that's labeled Take 12 as the keeper, so we're assuming that there were some breakdowns there. The song, along with its parent album, are shelved throughout 1969. Paul produces a cover of it in April for an Apple Records signed band called Mortimer, but that release is also shelved due to cuts at Apple made by Alan Klein, and probably also because that's the worst band name of all time. The song is eventually released on May. The song is eventually released in May of 1970 as the first song on the Let It Be album. Of course, it was never performed in concert by the band, but it was added to Paul's set for the first time in 2003 and was present off and on and has not been heard from since 2011. So why do I have two of us at 112? So this is another one that I'll start this whole spiel by saying I pretty much think I blew this one. I don't know why I have it at 112. I was trying to think back to when I did the rankings. Maybe I was drunk. I don't know. Over the last few years, I've played this song a lot in my Beatles cover band. And between that and watching the Beatles work it out and play it and Get Back, I really have no idea how I have this here. I think this should definitely be at minimum top 100. There's a lot to love in this song. You know, obviously, starting off with John and Paul's vocal, I love that because of the sheer amount of bootlegs and versions of this available, what we do hear through Get Back in Anthology and the box set and all that, vocally, there's always really good performances of this song that any two singers would be more than happy to have as their vocal take. But the one that we get on the official version is just the one. Like, they're so in sync on it. They're so locked in vocally, and it feels so natural. It's just beautiful. The other benefit of all the other versions that we get is hearing how they end up with the arrangement that they do. And we've talked in the past about the Beatles being amazing self-editors, and this is certainly one of those times. I think, however, Glenn John should maybe get the credit for that, having suggested from the beginning that they do it acoustic. And it's interesting that this song took such a wild journey to get to where it does, kind of pushing the original arrangement, butting heads about it, George leaving, coming back, trying it the same way again, then finally acquiescing to the idea of acoustics. I just find that a really interesting journey that this kind of simple song takes. Ringo provides the perfect groove behind it. It's literally just enough to let the song do what it needs to do. I love the kind of quasi bass part that George plays. And while I can kind of see what Paul says about having no bass on the song, I think having the counter melody that that part provides and that little bit of low end is right. And I think George is right to do it on the guitar as opposed to actually on the bass because it keeps the proceedings appropriately light. I'm a bit torn on the song being completely about just Paul and Linda. I do wonder if Paul's maybe being a bit guarded in his thoughts about it. Now, yes, I do think a lot of it is about him and Paul and Linda. I think the main source of it is. And there are interviews where he calls out, you know, just about every line in the song and mentions what they're about. They're about him and Linda. Or he calls out, you know, burning matches as being about him and his brother as children, being fascinated by matches and fire. You know, and he even owns up that the line spending someone's hard-earned pay is there purely because it scans well vocally and syllabically. But the line chasing paper, getting nowhere, I can't find him saying anything about that particular line. And that's the one that gets referenced a lot as about being about Apple business and about him and John. So while I don't doubt that he and Linda are probably the big muse of the song, I can't help but think that maybe the second closest relationship that he has, which is John, is also present in here somewhere. And maybe that's part of why this is always presented as a dual vocal from the beginning. But, you know, all in all, I love this song. It's gorgeous. It's melodically perfect, as Paul is wont to do. and for a song that was like the source of such real tension, it just feels easy. Like, it doesn't feel forced. But, yeah, it's a great song. I blew it. This is should be well higher than 112. My bad. Sorry about that. Brian, Simon, I throw it to you guys. Whoever would like to go first, what do you think?
Wow. Well, what's to say that hasn't already been said? I would have rated it higher, personally. It's sort of a low-key favorite of mine, this one.
Yeah.
It's definitely the song from Let It Be that I return to the most. Sometimes I just feel like listening to that song, you know, and I'll stick it on, even if I don't necessarily want to hear the full album. I just love it's got that sort of like a sort of rustic charm to it, which is reflected in that picture of that you mentioned of Paul in the car writing it in the middle of the countryside. It's sort of, you know, I already loved the song before I saw that photo, but it's sort of, that's almost why I envisaged when I heard the song before I'd seen that photo, Paul in the, you know, in the countryside playing it on an acoustic. You mentioned the vocals. I love the Everly Brothers aspect of it. Paul and John really seem to be connecting on that song. And it's another example. I guess Ballad of John and Yoko was another one that showed how even during a quite a torrid period for them, and their relationship, he could always set that aside and make good music together. They were always sort of on the same musical wavelength, even if there were personal issues going on. I would agree. It's there's definitely lines about John in there. It feels to me, it is sort of dual purpose.
Yeah.
There's a romantic element to it, which is obviously him and Linda, but there's a wistful nostalgia to it as well, which has to be him and John, really. Yeah. The chasing paper line as well.
Well, even, you know, you and I have memories longer than the road that stretches out ahead, and he's only been with Linda for like 8 months.
Well, yeah. And that line, actually, it struck me just re-listening to it again today, how much more poignant that line is now, given that really that it was literally true.
Mm-hmm.
For, in terms of their relationship, because John only had another 10 years to live after that song was released, whereas they'd known each other for 12, 13 years before that. So they did have all that, those memories together and that life together. And then but not that much left, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So that sort of makes that line more. Obviously, Paul could never have known that writing. That's the beauty of songwriting as well, isn't it? You know, a line that someone writes at a particular time can just take on this whole other relevance, you know, years down the line.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, so I don't know what thoughts you have.
No, that's a really powerful thought. I hadn't thought about the time that they had left together. But I do think that the song obviously makes reference to more than just Linda. And I think that's a pretty typical thing for McCartney and for other songwriters, you know, for any songwriter, to use a song as a vehicle for saying something and then to kind of take screen grabs of other things almost as you go through, you know, things that might strike you as being relevant to the topic. You know, if you've got this kind of typically jaunty McCartney song, which is quite wistful and is about finding your way with someone, to then say, oh, well, what about my relationship with John, or what about my relationship with my brother, or whatever. It's pretty typical to just draw on other memories. So I do think that that's what it draws on. And we know for a fact that McCartney does make references like that to John in other songs, doesn't he? You know, particularly when it comes to kind of contractual stuff, you know, his references.
Yeah,
to,
you're never giving me your money. He's got the funny paper reference.
Yeah, that sort of thing. So yeah, I think it is a lovely song. I can understand why it didn't make the top 100, because there are so many other monumental compositions and recordings that, you know, obviously you might want to rank higher than this. This is not necessarily one that the sort of casual fan would know, I think.
Yeah.
But for people like us who want to look in depth at the words and the performances and stuff, and as you say, there's a lot to recommend, and it does come from that lovely image and that sense of Paul doing what he does best, which is to basically disappear to some sort of rural place, pick up an acoustic guitar and you know, conjure up something great. One thing that was interesting was when I started thinking about this song is that it pushed me to take a look at that TV movie from 2000 called Two of Us, which is supposed to dramatize the Paul and John reuniting at the Dakota. And I had sort of a vague memory of this existing, but hadn't ever paid any attention to it whatsoever. So I didn't even know that it was Aidan Quinn and Jared Harris who were starring in it as McCartney and Lennon.
Directed by Michael Lindsay Hogg, isn't it, as well?
Is it really?
Which is a strange connection, because obviously he'd been with the real people doing the real thing. And then it's supposed to dramatise that particular moment where Lorne Michaels on Saturday Night Live offered the Beatles a chance to come to the studio and perform for, I think it was like $3,000 or something, wasn't it? And they dramatise that moment of McCartney and Lennon saying, oh, should we go down there? And like, grab a guitar, let's do it, that sort of thing. Which I didn't realise had ever been kind of dramatised in any way. So, yeah, just thinking about this song pushed me to discover something totally new. So that was really nice.
Is it terrible?
It suffers from that thing that a lot of Beatles dramatisations suffer from, which is that they don't hire Scouse people to play the roles. You know, and
a lot of bad accents.
Everybody tries to do their best with the Scouse accent, but it's such a specific thing that, you know, almost nobody gets it quite right. They all just do a kind of generic Ringo style. You know, make it a bit sharper if you'd cast as John, you know.
Yeah, a bit more nasal for John, yeah. We're comparing ourselves to Jesus, you know.
That's the one.
You know, okay, you know I love a bad movie. You might actually get me to watch that.
Yeah. It's pretty bad. I haven't watched it. Isn't there a bit where they put on like fake beards and go run through Central Park or something? Like
I was only watching sort of sections of it on YouTube, but I've heard there's something about disguises in there. But,
yeah.
Is that the one that's got the scene where they dramatize John like putting a brick through Paul's window?
Or is that another? That one. Oh, what's that one? It's like, McCartney, you bastard!
Yeah, who do you think you are? Yeah, yes, that might be a different one then. Yeah, no, there's a DJ over here called Sean Keaveney, and he would play that bit. Who do you think you are, McCartney? Like, every day on the show at some junks, he'd never announce it, he'd just stick it in somewhere in the show, you know.
McCartney! Who the hell do you think you are?
I love that, because, like, the best they could do was, like, well, you know, in 1969, John wore a white suit on the cover of Abbey Road. So let's make sure he's wearing that same suit the day he puts the brick through the window at McCartney's house.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Terrible.
This is spectacular news.
What do you think?
Apparently, he did actually do that, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
But I don't know that
I think
I don't know that he...
This was a sorry. No, oh, just, okay. It was a few months after the Get Back sessions, I think, wasn't it? I think it was around the time of the...
I feel like it was maybe after Abbey Road.
Okay, yeah, because they were getting on not too bad, I think, during Abbey Road, yeah. And then I think there were more business squabbles.
Then it kind of starts to fall apart there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So he literally did clamber over the wall of the house in St. John's Wood and put a brick through his window, yeah.
McCartney, you bastard.
The old teddy boy coming back with a vengeance there, right. John, I think.
In his designer white suit and lace button-down shirt. Yeah. What are you thinking, Julia? What are your thoughts on Two of Us?
Are you sure you're ready for this?
I might as well just take whatever's coming my way because I'm going to get butchered for this one.
Oh, you blew it.
I totally
blew it. This is terrible. I'm so embarrassed for you right now.
Thank you.
I'm just kidding. Go on. I mean, it is your opinion and this is my opinion. So we're all entitled to ours. I love this song. I
love the all caps on your notes.
You blew it. I did. Like in my little notes that I put on my phone for every episode. You blew it. So I think it's so charming. And it's like warm and fuzzy. It's like McCartney sentimental song without the schmaltz like your favorite like Long and Winding Road.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like it gets you like right in the, like you can feel like everyone has, well, I don't know, maybe not everyone. Most people have someone that they can sort of apply these feelings to, like someone that you've known for a long time or been in a relationship with a long time, and like it's a good feeling song.
Sure.
Like it's sentimental without being schmaltzy, which is like the sweet spot. I think, although we all know I'll probably never do my own ranking because I'm entirely too lazy, this song would definitely be in my top 50, quite possibly in my top 10.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Like I love this song. Every time I hear it, every time you play it, like it always snaps me right into paying attention. Like if I'm just sort of like off and, you know, how you just sort of drift off, like I've heard the song 8 million times. I know what's happening. But whenever that one comes on, snaps me right back into attention. My foot is tapping. I'm like bopping my head because it's just like so, I don't know. It's just like such a good beat. It's such a good vibe. Like it's so good. I just really, really like this song.
Yeah.
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 I wonder.
No, I think him.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I think that's right, you know, about the sentimentality thing. It's unforced sentimentality, and it just has a natural feeling to it. There's nothing contrived.
Yeah.
The imagery is good. Like the best of Paul's songs, they just feel effortless. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And like you say, you know, I think anyone who's had a long relationship with a person, be it a friendship or anything, you know, can find something in there to attach themselves to, is, you know, you could say there are things in there, knowing the history of Paul and Linda and Paul and John, you could say, oh, well, he's talking about that there. But someone listening to that song who had no knowledge of any of that could find things to relate to in that lyric, which I think should be the aim of a song, really, you know, is not to be so specific that you exclude the listener. You know, the listener needs something to grasp. But that's true of so many Beatles songs. They were so relatable as people, and they made very relatable music, even when they were sort of at their craziest and most experimental. There was always something in there to draw people in, you know.
Yeah.
That was perhaps John's mission with his spoken intro, which is just so universal and relatable.
That, yeah. Yeah. Charles Hawtrey and the Deaf Aids.
Who can't relate to that?
Right. Hey? Yeah. Are you too familiar with the Teatles account?
Yes, we follow that on Twitter. Yeah.
Have you ever picked up a copy of the Teatles?
I keep meaning to. I never have.
Highly recommended. The newest version, I guess, of the new one that just came out. He sends a card with it, and it's...
Oh, I saw that, yeah.
I'd never actually seen a picture of Charles Hawtrey until this came in. I was like, is that what he looks like? Oh, my God.
Well, yeah. Well, if you're not from the UK, so you wouldn't necessarily know the Carry On films. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of those?
Uh-uh.
A franchise of British comedy films, which ran from the late 50s to the late 70s. sort of a lot of innuendo, British seaside postcard humour, my caricature characters and things. And Charles Hawtrey was, and it was a team of actors who were in like many of the films. I don't know how many were made, but they had the sort of a repertory company. So you had people like Sid James and Kenneth Williams and Charles Hawtrey. And so that's, he's most familiar to people over here through those movies. Although, like a lot of the actors in the Carry-Ons, he was a classically trained like theatre actor, but ended up being known for these bawdy, kind of cheap British comedy films, you know, I love, actually. I've got a real soft spot for those.
I kind of want to watch these. That sounds pretty great.
I mean, they're very, they're fun. But I mean,
they all have titles like Carry On Matron and stuff like that.
Yeah, Carry On Regardless, Carry On Cabbie, Carry On Loving.
Carry On the Khyber.
A lot of the humour is not dated well, should we say.
Sure.
You wouldn't get some of these films off the ground now, really.
Right.
I don't think. Yeah. A lot of, you know, some actors in brown face in certain roles. You know, so you've got so there's questionable aspects, but it was different times.
Different times, yeah.
We were just visiting some family, and one of my nieces graduated from high school, so we went up for her graduation, and we decided to what were they watching? They were watching some movie. And,
10 Things I Hate About You.
Oh, yeah. And we were like, have you ever seen Can't Hardly Wait? And she was like, no. And I was like, oh, it's like a high school graduation movie, like from when we graduated high school. We should watch it. And so we put it on. And there was a couple of times where we were like, ooh, this did not age well. Yeah. Yikes. I forgot about that part. Moments, yeah. It was very awkward.
The Carry-Ons are definitely a period piece, I would say.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
You know, before we move too far from two of us, one of the things I was thinking about with how much you enjoy this song is I feel like this is kind of that late Beatle era McCartney where there's a very, like to me at least, a very obvious through line to early Wings of like the more acoustic stuff on Wildlife or Ram, like or a song like Another Day. This does not feel very far removed from. And I almost wonder if that's why you like it so much, because you
maybe.
Like
this is my wheelhouse stuff. Yeah, this is my wheelhouse. These are
because actually I think Another Day especially was written around the same time, because he demos that on piano during Get Back.
Yes, he does.
Yeah,
yeah.
So maybe this is all kind of that same period that you like so much.
Maybe
it starts here in early '69.
Yeah,
so there you go.
Okay, yeah. Nailed it.
Paul was always so good at those sort of acoustic down-home ditties, wasn't he? You know,
he still
so
is.
Many examples.
Like, he really still is. Yeah. That's the thing. Like, it's just the talent that he just can pick up an acoustic and come up with a beautiful melody and just kind of, it just falls out, you know?
God damn him.
Right.
McCartney, you bastard.
Who do you think you are?
Who do you think you are? Oh, it's so good. All right, so at 112, guys, am I way off base? Because I think I'm way off base. Can we all agree I ate it here?
Yeah, I mean, I would rank it higher, as I said. I've never even thought about ranking Beatles songs. So, I mean, it's hard for me to... maybe I'd put it in the top 100.
Yeah,
for sure. I think it's as Si said, you know, it doesn't loom as large maybe in people's minds of what the Beatles are, because it doesn't insist upon itself as it's got that very gentle, easy quality to it. It doesn't sort of beat you over the head. It just sort of sits there. On Let It Be, and it's there to be discovered. As I say, it's definitely a one that I come back to. I mean, I come back to the Beatles again and again anyway, but if I want to listen to a Beatles song, I will reach for that one quite a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a good feeling. Just, you know, as Julia said, it just makes you feel good to hear it.
For sure.
You know.
Brian, I feel like this is landing in your top 50. You're selling it.
it may well be, yeah. I'd have to go away and really think about, you know, as I say, I've never even attempted to rank. Even, you know, coming up with the top 10 would be almost impossible. Mm-hmm. I could probably do it with the guns in my head, but
we promise we won't do that. Despite what you may think about Americans, we won't do that.
Yeah. It's the part of the interview process we haven't talked about. Yeah, someone will be knocking on your door shortly. Oh, man. Simon, how about you?
You know, I'm cool with 112.
Yeah? Okay.
Interesting.
Okay.
No, I think you're right that it probably, if I did actually take the time to try and come up with the 111 other Beatles songs that I like more, I might struggle. So, yeah I think it's probably top 100.
Yeah.
But until I went through that very lengthy process, I wouldn't know really where it would land. But, yeah, let's say I think you were a tad ungenerous.
Yeah, I think so too.
Ungenerous. Ooh, I like that. I'm going to use that.
That's how British people say you blew it.
Yeah. Yeah. When I do the great re-rankening.
The great re-rankening.
At the end of this podcast.
I love how it, you know, if you hear the earlier versions of the song compared to what ended up on the album, you can really hear just how good the judgment was, because you know there's the rockier upbeat versions that you see them doing on Get Back, and I think in Let It Be as well, which have the charm, you know. It would have sounded fine if they'd done it that way, but they weren't satisfied. They sort of knew, and yeah, I think it was Glyn Johns who said, do you think you should just do it acoustically?
Yeah.
And they listened to him. They didn't just go, oh, what do you know? They sort of listened to, and yeah, this does work much better this way, and then the final product is exactly as it should be.
Yeah.
But I love hearing those early iterations, because you know them trying. There's so many examples of that throughout the anthology as well. Versions of earlier versions of songs where you're like, yeah, they were, you know, this isn't bad in any way, but they knew we can improve this. You know, they just had such good judgments and good taste.
Yeah.
Which again is just why I think so many of those songs still hold up so well.
Yep. They were so good at editing themselves and just cutting out unnecessary crap. Like it's always, they're the best at that. Mm-hmm. Between them and George Martin and I guess Glenn Johns for this particular one, like they're just, that's their move, man.
Yeah.
Well, before we wrap for the day, guys, can we do some rapid fire questions?
Certainly.
Awesome. And as usual, these are almost never rapid-fire answers, so take your time, whatever works for you. This has never, ever been a rapid
part
of this
not.
Podcast. All right. Your favorite Beatles song. And it can be of all time, it could be today, whatever fits your answer. Go ahead.
So you go first.
I think it would have to be today because, you know, I love sort of the rockers. I love Back in the USSR. I love Lady Madonna. I love those sort of songs. I love the emotional, the big slam dunks like Long and Winding Road and Something and In My Life and these sorts of songs. I like the big epics like A Day in the Life and She's Leaving Home and Eleanor Rigby. And so to pick one is very hard. But if I go on the theme of today and do away with all that genius, You Never Give Me Your Money.
Oh,
I think there's an absolutely stunning piece of music that creates a gorgeous mood. It's got lovely lyrics, and as Brian said earlier, you know, he just drops lines like or phrases like funny papers in there just to make it extra special, and it has that connection to Two of Us in the way that it sort of hints at that kind of contractual conflict. So I'll go with that one for today.
I love it. Brian, how about you?
I guess the temptation is to go for the epics, you know, the day in the Lives and I Am the Walruses, which would probably both be in my top 10, actually, again, of songs that I can't get over. These things exist.
Right.
You know, how did these people do this?
Right.
You know, I marvel at them every time. And I might be one of the few people who gets emotional here in I Am the Walrus, which might sound weird.
I love it. That's great.
It's just for that reason. I'm not necessarily going to say this is my favorite, but
sure.
You know, it just the coming together of all those components and First of all, just the idea in the first place, the way they execute it, George Martin's cello arrangements, the weird sound effects, just the whole kit and caboodle, really, of that song. It's just, I get to the end and I'm like, it's staring to me, you know, in a way that, you know.
Oh, sorry, that was
the motorcycle.
A very loud, yeah, something going by. That was weird.
Thought that was Brian being stirred.
Yeah, that's kind of what it sounds like. Yeah,
we're leaving that in
when it happens. Right. So, yeah, I find, you know, because there are songs that you're supposed to get emotional to, I guess. There's the In My Life, which obviously is a very touching song. Mm-hmm. But then I sometimes get emotional at the brilliance of
yeah
things. Like I Am the Walrus, just how great that sounds and that these guys from where I come from managed to conjure this. Same with A Day in the Life. It's just such an extraordinary thing that, and no one's really come close to it.
Yeah.
In terms of a song or a production, really, and you know, to think that those guys created that 3-4 years after Please Please Me, you know,
yeah,
just mm-hmm. that the leap yeah. involved there is it boggles the mind. But in more recent years, because has jumped to the fore as a real favorite, a real definite top 10, just the uncommon beauty of it, the sound of those layered voices, Paul, John, and George, and I think triple tracked, isn't mm-hmm. it? I believe, and just that sort of harpsichord. Is it a harpsichord or something simple? Yeah, and just the simplicity of it. That's really it. It's just voice, harpsichord, and a bit of Moog bass. Mm-hmm. You know, Moog bass, sorry, I should say. And it's just, you know, you can look at the big productions like I Am the Walrus, Day in the Life, Strawberry Fields, and then you hear this, and this is what, the simplicity, like, strip back, voice, harpsichord, a little bit of bass synth, and it just stops you in your tracks to hear. It does for me, and again, just gets me.
Yeah.
And it's very kind of a simple... Such a simple lyric, almost nursery rhyme-esque, you know, but set to that musical arrangement, it becomes something profound.
Yeah.
And that's, again, the amazing thing about songwriting. You can take a very simple set of words, an almost childish sentiment or childlike, attach it to this music, and you've got something that's just, again, just stops you in the tracks. And you know, Simon mentioned You Never Give Me Your Money, and I think the transition between that into You Never Give Me Your Money on Abbey Road is just, it's like when those major seventh chords begin. Is I wanna live in that moment, you know. I wanna crawl inside that few seconds and just live there, because it's just perfection to me. Mm. So because is one of them. I mean, I'm not going to go so far as to say I'd want to play it at my funeral, because we want to try and keep things light. But
Julie,
it is.
Knows it.
So probably today, I would say Because.
I love it. Fantastic.
What a great explanation. Yeah. Like we said, never rapid.
Never rapid.
But I'm always
I
glad.
Do rapid.
Yeah, I'm always glad when it's not rapid, because that was like such a beautiful explanation of like a song that, you know, doesn't get talked about too terribly often.
Yeah, and again, it's another one of those that it's just sitting there on on side two of Abbey Road, and it doesn't yell, look at me, you know. But when you discover it, it's like, oh my God, this is just, you know, unbelievably gorgeous.
Yeah.
Just hanging out, sitting there, waiting for you to waiting to wrap around you like a nice cozy sweater.
Yeah, and I honestly think that's one of the songs that maybe casual Beatles fans or people who, you know, God help them, dismiss the Beatles or you know, Beatles say the Beatles are overrated or whatever. It's like, no, I don't. I think you're just thinking of mop tops and woo and think, you know, that's what you're thinking of. That's your, you know, you've got a very limited perspective on the scope of what they actually did. Things like that. I think if you played Because or Two of Us or any number of songs to a very casual Beatles fan or someone who'd never really cared for the Beatles before, they'd rethink their stance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Agreed. Your least favorite Beatles song is the one that you just can't stand. You skip it every time.
Oh, go on, Si.
I don't really have most hated things, I suppose, probably because I know how hard it is to do anything.
Yeah.
But there's probably plenty of things that I don't connect with very much. Probably, I love the White Album, but there's some things on there that I find a little bit kind of just slightly beyond the pale, you know.
Sure.
And some stuff that's so 60s that it sort of makes my teeth ache. You know, like Savoy Truffle or something like Ooh. That, which is just like a bit. I mean, I like it, but it's so kind of Austin Powers that I can just do it. So I'll go with that for today. But I apologize because, you know, tomorrow I'll probably think, oh, yeah, I like that one.
I will say, you know, this is probably blasphemy coming from a city where horns are such a big part of our music here. But my favorite horn sounds are the horns on Savoy Truffle, where they're compressed and distorted and gnarly, and like they take the place of a guitar. Like, I think that's the coolest trick. I love that.
Yeah, so. I think that's the best part of that song, actually, is the horn arrangement.
It is.
And the sound. It's, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, phenomenal. Least favorite, Brian.
Oh, wow. I guess, I mean, there's no Beatles song I would say I actively dislike. I think I can honestly say that. There are just some that I just think, again, I don't gravitate towards very much, or I just don't think are quite as maybe memorable or have that much to recommend them. I mean, one I've never been keen on is Don't Pass Me By, again, going to the White Album.
Sure.
But it's not so much the song, actually. It's the arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a little bit sluggish and, as a jaunty country song, it's and I think he's actually done a version of it recently, Ringo, in the last couple of years, more akin to like a light country treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually works really nicely.
Hmm.
And I think that's how it was written, but somehow it got bogged down in fiddles and and just that lumping sort of arrangement that's on the White Album.
Yeah,
it's very ploddy. Mm-hmm. And and so it's not the song. The song's perfectly charming. The record is, but you know, I mean, it still belongs. I'm not one of these people who say, oh, if only they'd done this and if only they'd taken that off, put that on. No, that's the decision they made, and I'm cool with that, you know. I'd actually go for, again, I don't dislike it, but some long. Poor George is coming in for a kicking. but yeah, it's. Again, I like the recording.
Mm-hmm.
I like the gentleness and the way it's just the dynamic changes and things. And I love that like fade out. I think it was a wine bottle on top of the Leslie speaker starting to rattle.
Yeah,
and it so creates this kind of slightly startling moment at the end of the song, which might be my favourite moment in the song. But it's just a little. Feels slightly half-assed as a song. It just doesn't grab me. And still, it's probably one of the few Beatles songs that, okay, I know how the verse goes. How does the rest of it go?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't sit here now and sing you the other bits, like the B section.
Interesting.
I can only sort of sing you the first bit.
That's the section that I think of the most with that song. There's so many.
Is that right?
As I was searching.
Well, now that you say it, right? Yeah, that's it. But you had to prompt me. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's how it goes, but I don't need that for virtually any other Beatles song. But I cannot immediately dial into how that bit goes.
Right.
So for me personally, that's like a problem, you know, why can't I remember that bit?
I think with that song it's because it's so quiet. It's the quietest thing on that record. You have to turn
it could be.
You gotta turn the volume up to hear the song. And
yeah,
I think that's why it doesn't connect. I've always wondered about that.
Yeah, that might be right. Yeah, I don't question its inclusion on the record.
Yeah.
Everything to me, what makes that album great is even the bits that I'm not as keen on personally. You know, but they still belong there, and it wouldn't be the same if those things were taken out. You know, some people despise Wild Honey Pie. I personally really quite like Wild Honey Pie, and wouldn't take it off that album. You know, for anything.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be there. I'm trying to think if there's any others that maybe. No, that would be the one I'd gravitate towards, just because of that, for that reason, that it just doesn't it just doesn't stick in my head, and for a Beatles song, that's an issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Favorite Beatles album?
I oscillate between one of the two. Rubber Soul and the White Album.
Okay.
Yeah, Rubber Soul, just because it felt like a leap in terms of songwriting and arranging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, inclusion of the sitar on Norwegian Wood, and like a song like Girl, which they'd never really done before. And, you know, just the idea of having like In My Life buried on like side two of that album is crazy. You know, how can you have a song that good? Just sitting on, but they could afford to do that. You know, again, there's some great, I think relatively for the casuals, undiscovered songs like I'm Looking Through You and You Won't See Me and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Great, you know, a couple of great Paul, underrated Paul songs. And just holds together, I think, of all their albums, it just feels like everything belongs on that record. It's cohesive. Yeah. And then White Album, for the kind of the opposite reason, because it's just this great sprawling, eclectic mix of styles and sounds, and and they were kind of becoming fragmented as a band, and you can hear that, but there's also these very unified moments on it too. You can hear them working as a band on stuff like Blues and Helter Skelter and stuff. You can hear a band that it's, you know, working together. But then you've got these beautiful solo moments as well that sort of point towards their solo careers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like Blackbird and Julia and, impossibly gorgeous things like Dear Prudence, weird stuff like Happiness is a Warm Gun. Paul's musical side is represented in there, you know. It's just, just all of life is in that album. And so, I listen to them all on a semi-regular basis, all the albums, but those are the two I probably come back to the most.
Yeah. Simon, how about you?
Well, when you asked, I was thinking immediately probably Sgt. Pepper, just for the kind of vision of it, you know, and the expansive kind of nature of it. But then I was thinking a bit more about Magical Mystery Tour as well, as a kind of, just to be annoying and weird. I know it's a strange choice because it's such a kind of scrappy collection of things, isn't it? You know, I guess it was a soundtrack and then singles, and there was an EP, and then there was a kind of a US LP which had everything on. But if you look at that US LP, if it's got Magical Mystery Tour and Fool on the Hill and Your Mother Should Know and I Am the Walrus and Hello Goodbye and Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane and All You Need Is Love,
yeah,
I say name me a more iconic set.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll wait.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I've had that same thought recently.
It's
like,
crazy if you look back at that, isn't it? It's insane.
Like pound for pound,
it's stacked.
What other collection of hits do you have on a studio album? You know, like that's insanity.
No, true. And I even enjoy now the lesser songs, like even like Flying, you know, which is sort of a unique thing in the catalogue. It's a Lennon McCartney Harrison Starr composition, which I think is the only one.
I think so.
In the catalogue.
Mm-hmm.
And even that, you know, it's just really a bluesy instrumental, but they still found a way to make that interesting with that top line, da, 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 you know, and the little guitar descending. It's our thing. They still found a way to make even like it just what's a pretty basic bluesy jam, melodically interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's got atmosphere to it. And then, like, you know, a few years ago, if you asked me about my least favorite song, I might have said Blue Jay Way. But now when I hear that, I'm like, I kind of like this. It's a very weird, unsettling thing, but really interesting melody. Kind of very of its, you know, very of 67 in its way, but yeah, it's a great, you know, George kind of wrote a lot of songs about being bored. but that's probably his best one.
Yeah.
And but again, years ago, I don't know, it sort of didn't sit right with me. I couldn't, similarly to Within With You, Without You, actually, that was one I was never keen on in the past. But, and again, that's another fantastic thing about the Beatles. You can go back and reassess songs that maybe you didn't care for, say 10, 15, 20 years ago, and go, do you know what? Now I get this now.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. This works for me. I get it. I understand. You know, so no, that's a good choice, Simon. Well done. Approved.
Well done. I know we're getting short on time. So the last one is your favorite Beatles associated memory, whether it was, you know, something important happened and, you know, Sergeant Pepper was playing at the same time, or I don't know, you met Paul McCartney, you know, yeah. That's always a popular one.
I think we're going to agree on this one, aren't we, Simon?
I mean, we started with my pilgrimage to Paul, as I mentioned, and yeah, it's got to be that, hasn't it? Because we had we had quite a long history of kind of almost connecting with him, didn't we? Like,
we're in the same room a few times.
Yeah, and because we saw him at Lipper for the first time not long after Linda died, and he turned up at the graduation, and then when I graduated, I got to shake hands with him, and he said, thanks for coming. and then we saw him perform live in Manchester, didn't we, and in Liverpool
a couple of times. Yeah, 2003 it was, yeah, back in the world tour.
Yeah,
I think
I saw
was.
Him here in the States for that.
When we became podcasters, we ended up going to Abbey Road and starting to see that history there, and then we had this unbelievable experience that happened in the same week that we interviewed Paul. I don't know if you want to mention what happened at Abbey Road, and then,
well, yeah, it, well, it was just the most incredible, I guess, 72 hours in which we were booked to interview Nile Rodgers at Abbey Road on the Monday.
A good get.
Yes, yeah. Well, another of our heroes, so that just added to the craziness of the whole thing. So this was like late July 2018. So yeah, we were invited down to interview Nile on. That Monday, and while you know, after we booked Nile, there were rumblings that we might get Paul. We were in touch with his publisher Stuart, and you know, but it was still a little bit up in the air. To be honest, until it happened, I was convinced it wouldn't happen. I thought something's going to get in the way of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was ongoing, and then it seemed to be happening. I think the Friday before, Stuart called you, hadn't he, Si, and said, I think he'd asked for some figures, like download figures and things for the podcast to present to Paul's management, you know, to seal the deal, I think, because Stuart was very keen for us to do it because he was like a fan of our show, but he had to sort of, you know,
sell it
to the management, you know, because it's just standard for any artist of Paul's like magnitude, really.
Sure.
So, still it was a little bit, is this going to happen? But anyway, we were in Abbey Road on the Monday. Interview Nile, and we've heard that something's going on with Paul at Abbey Road that day, just by coincidence the day we were going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
This thing underneath the staircase, I'm like, I wonder what that is. We interview Nile anyway, and then we're sort of chatting to Nile, which in itself is like, this is wow, unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Your dream come true. And then the next minute, the kind of the general manager of Abbey Road, all the promotion and stuff, the marketing, walks in with a couple of wristbands, says, right, guys, if you want to head to Studio 2, you know.
We just sort of then floated down the corridor. We didn't touch the floor. We just kind of...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we didn't really know. Yeah, go on, sir, you pick it
so
up.
So we came into this space, and there was loads of people in there, and there's a stage set up in the middle of Studio 2, and we're under this staircase, the famous Studio 2 staircase. And then I think Brian said to me, God, that guy looks just like Johnny Depp. I was like, it is Johnny Depp. and then we turned, and there's like, that's Amy Schumer, and that's Orlando Bloom, and that's Stormzy, and that's Kylie Minogue. We realized we were in this very, very exclusive space, and someone had probably made a terrible mistake. But
we found out afterwards there were like 90 people at this thing, and we were two of them.
Wow.
And so, yeah, we thought, because I'd heard this underneath the staircase thing, and I thought maybe is it going to be like the Chaos and Creation at Abbey Road thing that he did mm-hmm. in like 2005, you know, with Tim just playing through a few songs on his own and with an invited audience. But then when we got in there, and there's a whole back line set up, drums, keyboards, amps, everything. I'm like, oh shit, this is a gig. So I stood there, and then, you know, we were there maybe 10, 15 minutes, and then Paul emerges from the control room, comes down the stairs with the band.
And he floats down, I'm sure.
And he floats down, yeah, he floats down, and came on stage. And then it turned out basically, yeah, it was a full 90-minute concert being recorded for Spotify exclusively. So it was being filmed, cameras all weaving in and out of us. Giles Martin was up in the control room recording it.
Wow.
And we were just like agog, to be honest. We just couldn't honestly believe.
We just had jelly arms for 90 minutes just laughing like this.
The whole thing was a highlight, but at one point he was about to start Lady Madonna, and he was on his like magic piano, you know, the psychedelic painted one.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, well, actually, you know, that piano over there is the one I recorded it on. And he jumps off stage, sits down at the Mrs. Mills piano, plays the riff, and then goes to get up and go back on stage. And then he turns up to Giles and goes, actually, do you want me to she'll do it on this? And Giles goes, yeah, it's mic'd up, it's ready to go. So Paul, you know, plays Lady Madonna on the Mrs. Mills piano while the band kicked in as well, you know, and we were literally stood around him in a sort of semicircle because the piano was against the wall, and he's just, and I remember the mic, there's something wrong with the mic stand, so it was quite low, so he was having to stoop to do it. Just a funny detail I remember.
So we just crowded round this piano, basically just stood round him while he played
telling you about it now, I still can't quite believe it.
Yeah.
And then so we had that, and then on our way out of there that day we bumped into Stuart Bell, Paul's publicist, and he made encouraging noises about like Wednesday, which is when the interview was with him was scheduled to be. So and then fast forward to Wednesday, and we did it at Lippa, the interview, which you mentioned before.
Oh, nice.
And so we had to go there at the interview wasn't scheduled till I think 5 p.m. but we had to be there at midday. Got there, we were met by Stuart, who took us through like the loading bay of Lippa and out into the what's it called, the Paul McCartney Auditorium, little theater within the college. And as we walk in, Paul's sound checking.
You're like, again? I just saw this. Like, yeah, do we have to do this?
Is this again? It would become an old hat by this point. So he's playing Confidant from Egypt Station,
mm-hmm.
which was the album we were going to be speaking to him about. So, and it's just him and Rusty and Brian on like acoustics, you know, and Abe just on like a snare with brushes. And it's like, oh, wow. So we just stood and watched that. And then Giles Martin was there again, wasn't he? I think just overseeing sound of things. And then we were sort of led out then into like the Lippa foyer, and then Stuart has this incredible way of just disappearing into thin air and then rematerializing at some later point when you don't see him come in the room. He's just suddenly on your shoulder. And so we were just sort of left, and then a security guy came over, I remember, and was like, yeah guys, where's your passes? We're like, oh, we're here with Stuart. And then eventually they found us, and we didn't get thrown out.
Oh my gosh!
And then there was a Q&A with Paul. He was doing a thing with Jarvis Cocker of Pulp.
Yeah.
Which actually we were initial idea, I think, was to have us do this live Q&A with him, and that would be our interview. But thankfully they got Jarvis to do it, because I don't think I could have coped with a live audience. So that was like 2 p.m, and he did this interview with Jarvis in front of an audience. And we sat and watched that. And then after that, they did a half-hour, 40-minute acoustic set, him and the band. First time he'd ever played live at Lippa.
Wow.
And I think it was the first time he ever did From Me to You since the Beatles days.
Really?
So, we're just drinking all this in. But funnily enough, I remember getting towards the end of that set, and we were thinking, it's getting... what time is it now? It's like 3:30, 4:00. Oh, we're going to be... Stuart said he was going to be it. And it's so funny because Paul's like 10 feet away playing From Me to You live for the first time in 60 years. And I'm starting to think, where's Stuart? I'm getting distracted, you know. And eventually Stuart reappeared on our shoulder again. And, you know, summoned us up to a room upstairs where Paul had like a dressing room set up and stuff. And then we had to kind of wait out there. And he was finishing an interview with Esquire, which became kind of an infamous interview. It's the one where he talked about the group. How can I say? Is this a family podcast? Mm,
yeah, you say whatever you need. You know what I'm going to? Yeah.
Well, the group masturbation thing he talked with John and well, that was the interview he was doing before we went in. So we had to sort of stand up. And we were like,
I've got to go meet with Soda Jerker. So
and they thought, yeah.
Something about jerky and just fell into his head.
Yeah, that was the theme of the day, yeah. So, and I remember us being stood outside because we were so determined not to waste a second because I think we had maybe 35 minutes.
Wow.
We knew we would have like 35 minutes. So it was like we were stood in the corridor, an otherwise empty corridor other than this huge, burly security guy with like cables around our holding all our gear like poised and ready for when the door opened and we could go in because we just didn't want to waste a second. And and I just got this vision then of finally going in the room and Paul being stood in the middle of the room on this kind of rug. They'd repurposed the room to make it a nice dressing room for him, so there's a nice rug on the floor and a sofa and nice lighting and candles, and he was just stood there and there was sun. It was kind of tea time, so it's like, you know, kind of late afternoon sun streaming in behind him, and it was like he was framed really kind of,
oh my goodness,
beautifully. In my amazing mind, I don't know if I've romanticized this in the years since, but that's how I kind of remember going in the room. He stood smiling.
He has that brought in. There's actually just a spotlight outside of a window.
Yeah,
he's got a spotlight guy that just shines it on him perfectly every time.
Yeah. He keeps the sun on the payroll.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. And then that was it, really. We got set up and did it, and any kind of nerves then I think had long gone out the window, as we've been there all day, and but the nerves had dissipated and we just wanted to get on and do it, and somehow we held it together and got a decent interview out of it with them. But so I mean, you know, what definitely our best Beatles related memory, I would say.
Turned out to be a good week.
You think?
So going back to the Abbey Road story, like when you were interviewing Niall at Abbey Road and they gave you wristbands, did you know what was happening?
We knew that something was going on, didn't we, Si?
Yeah, but we didn't really imagine it was going to be that. So it was just like, oh, okay, yeah, we'll go along and see.
So you didn't know it was McCartney. Is, you just thought it was
that he might be in the building, but we weren't really sure.
Okay.
We didn't want to.
Well, when we arrived, there were people out, there was a crowd of, there was fans outside when we got there, so okay. We were like, yeah, he probably is here, isn't he? And we kind of got ushered through the throng, you know, which was quite nice.
Very fancy.
Very important. Yeah, let us through.
Excuse me.
There was a sense, there was a buzz around that something was happening, but even at that point, we didn't dare think, oh, we're going to get to witness it, you know? And, right. And again, we thought, if anything, it's going to be either... Maybe it's a little solo show, I mean, which would have been unbelievable, I should add. Or maybe it's just an interview, maybe, for, you know, he's just going to sit and answer questions about the album or something. And never did we think we would end up with a free McCartney gig in Abbey Road Studio 2. That was, wow. Yeah. So,
yeah. Yeah, with like 88 other people.
Like 88 other people. Pure luck that day. I mean, we have a lot to thank Niall's assistant for. For getting us to come down on that day, because you know it could have been any other day and we'd have missed. I mean, you know, we still met Paul later in the week, but it's just this bonus thing that, you know, was just beyond anything we could imagine we'd get to see. So, yeah, it was a day to remember.
Yeah, you win.
Yeah, that's a pretty good answer to that question.
I think that goes to number one of Beatles associated memories. My goodness. Well, guys, this has been a blast. I can't thank y'all enough for doing this. For our listeners who are uninitiated, where can they find everything about Soda Jerker on songwriting? Where can they follow everything? What's the best hub for all that good stuff?
Well, you can find us on any podcasting platform, really. So just search for Soda Jerker on your favorite one. Or you can go to sodajerker.com and you can find all the episodes in full there. Or social media, just @SodaJerker on Instagram, you know, Twitter, all the usual platforms.
Yes, yes, yes. And for the two of you musically, what's out there for listeners to check out? Anything specifically that you'd like to direct them to?
No.
this is the great sort of irony, really, of being two people who do a songwriting podcast. It sort of made our own songwriting take a back seat.
Sure.
Just because of the sheer amount of work involved in putting the podcast together, and the fact that we have kids and jobs and all that, and it's something we literally do in our spare time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It began to take up a lot of our spare time for a while. So, but in the last couple of years, we've gotten back into. I mean, we were always writing and gathering ideas, and we've got a Dropbox folder full of stuff and what have you. But in the last couple of years, we've started getting together in size, well-appointed studio that you can see there, and actually getting in the room and writing together again, which has been lovely. And we've got some stuff we like. It's just a question of getting it into the best possible shape and recording it properly. And we want, before we put anything out there again, maybe it's because of the weight of all these great songwriters and artists that we've spoken to, we don't want to put anything half-assed out.
Sure.
We want it, because we feel like people will be like, oh, okay, all right then, songwriting podcasters, let's hear your little tunes, come on now, let's hear your little ditties. And we don't, we want to present something really of quality to people. So however long that takes is however long it takes. But yeah. We are writing together.
But it's coming.
Excellent.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, everybody, please go check out Soda Jerker on Songwriting, one of our favorite podcasts. Guys, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you all so much for taking some time to chat with us. We genuinely appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Jonathan, thanks. Julia, it's been a blast. Absolute blast.
Likewise.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And we will we'll chat with you all again soon.
Definitely. Okay.
Great.
Brian O'Connor and Simon Barber of Soda Jerker on Songwriting, you guys. What a joy.
They were so fun. That was such a great story, too.
That is probably one of the best stories I've ever heard.
What a great week.
Even though I knew what happened, I was like, what happened next? Did they get to meet him? Like, oh, my God. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's incredible. If you like music, which if you're here, I assume you do, songwriting is a big part of music.
Turns out.
And I suggest you check out their podcast to hear... from some of the greatest songwriters of all time, how they write songs and stories of their most recent albums and things. It's fantastic. It's a lovely podcast.
It's a lovely podcast.
Could not recommend it enough. Yeah.
So, it actually isn't. I will say, as a non-songwriter, it actually is very interesting. It's cool. It's interesting to hear about people's process.
Yes.
And their relationship to their music and their songs and all of that. So because it's maybe a little more interesting because I don't have that brain. So it's kind of nice to hear from people how their brains work.
Yeah.
Because it's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Because I've never written anything in my life.
Well, it's not too late to start.
I don't want to.
Julia's solo album coming in 2024.
Come on, you know how lazy I am. It's definitely going to be at least 2028.
That's true. Friends, what do you all think about two of us at number 112? Did I blow it?
Yeah.
You bet your sweet cheeks I did. I completely ate it on this one. I don't even know how I did this. I apologize. Drag me over the coals as you see fit. Let us know in the comments on all the social medias what you think about this episode and this ranking. Are we too high? Are we too low? Or just like Baby Bear's porridge, am I? You're not even going to say it because it's not even right.
Nope.
Not even in the ballpark.
I'm not giving you the pleasure today.
Wherever you want to blast me publicly, you can do it on Facebook at
Ranking the Beatles.
Or you can tear me a new one on Twitter at
Ranking the Beatles.
Or you can relentlessly mock me on Instagram at
Ranking Beatles.
Yes. So let us know what you think. Tell a friend how badly I'm doing over here. Let them know what you think about this podcast. And be sure you check out rankingthebeatles.com for all your Beatle ranking needs. T-shirts, posters, sweatshirts, all that good stuff. Yeah.
All right.
That's all we got, gang. So we'll see you next week. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Julia.
This has been Ranking the Beatles. Adios.
Bye, y'all.